going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Hey, it's me, Paige DeSorbo, and I'm so excited to share my new shoe collection at DSW, filled with my favorite styles and trends for spring. Because if you know me, you know I'm kind of obsessed with shoes. And by kind of obsessed, I mean head over heels. You're going to love these shoes. So snag super cute styles like cute flats, fun heels, and cool sneakers from the Paige DeSorbo collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Instacart is on a mission to have you not leave the couch this basketball season. Because between the pregame rituals and the postgame interviews, it can be difficult to find time for everything else. So let Instacart take care of your game day snacks or weekly restocks and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Because we hear it's bad luck to be hungry on game day. So download the Instacart app today and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first 3 orders. Service fees apply for 3 orders in 14 days. Excludes restaurants.
This is the Skate Podcast, talking Bruins hockey with WEEI Bruins writers Scott McLaughlin, Bridget Prue, and Brian DeFelice. Lace them up for some Bees talk. It's Odyssey's The Skate Pod on WEEI. Woo!
Welcome into episode 433 of the Skate Podcast. I am Brian DeFelice, joined by Bridget Prue and Scott McLaughlin. Bridget and Scott, today is a mailbag episode, so thank you all very much for submitting your questions. We'll get to as many as we can, hopefully all of them. Bridget and Scott.
In honor of Marathon Monday, we're doing a marathon mailbag. Strap in for 3 hours, everyone.
No. Yes.
I'm just kidding.
I gotta be somewhere. Sorry.
Yeah, no. We would do it, but people have, you know, things to do. So, first of all, hope you guys had a good weekend, nice holiday weekend. And then obviously Easter Sunday carries into Marathon Monday, as you guys just alluded to. So do you guys know anybody running in the marathon today?
I have like one friend from college, not one of my closest friends, but yeah, actually kind of low this year. Usually there's like at least a couple people I know running.
Yeah. My friend Steve's not running this year. He normally does.
I'll give my friend, Ben, a shout out. Ben, good luck to you today. I think it's his fifth marathon, fifth and last. So, and yeah, usually Marathon Monday in Boston is followed by, you know, a day game for the Red Sox and then a rowdy playoff atmosphere for the Bruins. Of course, not to rub salt in the wounds, but we're not getting that this year, unfortunately.
Nope. All the Garden got was a Easter Sunday Celtics game, which obviously Celtics are going to cruise past Orlando. But yeah, I mean, we got, what, five NHL playoff games over the weekend to start things off. And I'd say maybe not the best slate of games to start the playoffs just in terms of, you know, couple blowouts, couple games that were just pretty lopsided.
I was hoping for more from that Toronto-Ottawa game. I really wanted that to be more.
You got some hatred, but Ottawa didn't really look ready for the playoffs, and it's a lot of that team's first time going, so maybe that was to be expected. But yeah, they're gonna have to find a balance because they took a lot of penalties in that game. I'd say one definitely should not have been called. Maybe another one was a little ticky tack, but no, they were not disciplined, and it killed them. Toronto was able to kind of run it up on the power play and looked, you know, usually we're used to Toronto looking like the team that kind of gets deer in headlights in the playoffs, and they actually looked like the much more composed team in that game.
Yeah, and Marner had 3 points. So anybody who's hoping for Marner to have a bad playoffs and the price to not be that high on him, I think that that's probably not going to happen.
So I kind of feel a little differently. Like, I think the price is going to be astronomical for him regardless.
Yeah.
So if you're going to pay for him, like if you're going to play that game, then you'd rather spend $14 million after he has a strong postseason.
Yeah, because then we're talking, you know, a few months from now, oh, they signed Mitch Marner, but he did nothing in the playoffs. Why would they pay this much money for a guy who disappears in the playoffs? Like, yeah, that's what conversation would be had.
Yeah, I definitely think when it comes to the Senators, yeah, their nerves and inexperience, I think, definitely took over in game one. I would expect that series to probably settle in. Maybe in game two, they kind of flush some of those issues, and then they probably come roaring back in game three when they're playing at home for the first time in 8 years. But you know, just looking at the slate of games, to your point, Scott, not one of them was even a one goal game. I mean,
Winnipeg was until the empty netter.
Well, but Scott, technically what I said was right. I'm trying to make a point here. Stay with me. Bear with me. All right. So you had 5-3 Jets over the Blues, 5-1 Avs over the Stars, 4-1 Hurricanes over the Devils, which we talked about before we started recording. The Devils are not looking like they're in good shape this postseason with their injury issues. And then 6-2 with the Leafs over the Senators, Vegas over the Wild, 4-2, which is probably your other caveat, Scott, you were going to say, is a game that was closer than the score would say. But hopefully these series can be closer than what a lot of these scores were in game one.
Yeah, well, and Tampa, Florida is the one I was most excited for. And for some reason, you have to wait till Tuesday for game one of that series. Like, why is there game one 4 days into the playoffs? Don't really get that, but that's the series I'm most excited for anyways. I guess Battle of Ontario probably would have been second, but like Capitals Canadians is up there too.
I want all those series to go 7 games. I just want to see them play out and them to be close and competitive. Like I want to watch, I know this sounds like the opposite of what a Bruins person would say, but like, I want to see Montreal succeed at least to the extent of like making it an interesting series. And those fans have been itching for it. It's probably, I say this because we've been to that atmosphere a few times recently and knowing what it was like in the regular season in a pretty much meaningless game for the Bruins. It had importance for the Canadians, obviously. But it wasn't a playoff game. Like to see what that atmosphere is like in the playoffs, especially after being deprived of the playoffs for so long, I'm sure it's going to be insane. So like, I just want to see what the crowd really brings to that series when they make it up to Montreal.
Yeah, I would say that without a doubt, the NHL is a better product when the Montreal Canadiens are good. And you can be a Bruins fan and hate the Canadiens and probably admit that. And I think Canadiens fans would say the same in reverse. You don't want them to be good at your expense when it matters most, but the rivalry is better when both teams are good and competing with each other. I think the league is better when you have, you know, the teams with the history and dating back 100 years. For the original six teams, when they're good, the league is just better when those teams are good. You would want in a perfect world everybody to be competitive in a given year. But if I had to pick between the Canadiens being good versus the Utah Hockey Club, I'm going to want the Canadiens to be better. It's obviously an interconference example I just gave there, but you know what I mean. Like, I'm a Bruins fan, grew up hating the Canadiens, but I just think it's better when they're good. So I'm looking forward to that series. The other series I think I don't know if we mentioned was Kings Oilers. Looking forward to that one. But yeah, Scott, I don't know why the NHL schedule makers made it so that you have certain series playing game two before another series is even playing game one. It makes no sense to me.
How about the 11 o'clock start tomorrow? We were talking about this right before we got on, like, Tuesday is 6 p.m. is Devils Hurricanes, 7:30 Senators Leafs, 8:30 Panthers Lightning, 11 p.m., which, you know, because it's national TV, it normally starts 15 to 20 minutes after the time that it says it's going to start. So that's probably like an 11:20 puck drop. I don't intend on being awake for that. Maybe the first.
No, I definitely won't be, but I am curious to like see how this does, because what it does is it allows ESPN, the main network, not ESPN2, but main ESPN channel, to have a weeknight triple header, which obviously I don't, as far as I know, we've never seen outside of the bubble year where you had all kinds of weird times because everyone's playing on the same rink.
This is like when you leave your TV on for the entire day and then you just like the ratings stay the same because every single bar around the country has one TV tuned to ESPN or half their TVs tuned to ESPN. So it's just going to be on automatically if you have them all on the same channel. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's the play. Who knows?
And like so if you start the game at 10 instead of 11, it's like, well, most of that audience is still going to be West Coast and local market, right? Like, you're even at 10 o'clock, you're losing a lot of the East Coast audience. So I am interested to see if it works out. Like, we'll know, because if it works, like, ESPN's going to do it again next year. So I think this is kind of a trial run to see if, you know, a triple header starting at 6 and going to 2 a.m. Can work for them.
Mm. All right, so Bridget Scott, any comments before we get into the mailbag? Any of you have any reviews of WrestleMania or anything like that you guys want to go over? Get off your chest.
I did not watch a single second of WrestleMania. So, like, I'm not a big wrestling fan anyways, but the last couple of years I have tuned in because it's on Peacock, which I have, so I don't have to pay-per-view or anything. And, like, usually it's entertaining, but this year it takes place the same weekend that you get NHL and NBA playoffs starting. So it was too far down my list of priorities.
Yeah. Usually it's around the first week of April, not the third. So not really sure what happened there, but anyway, okay. Mailbag.
Sorry. One last thing I was going to mention. Did you realize that Charlie Coyle has a 7-game point streak now and 12 points in those 7 games?
Did not realize that.
Yeah, he got, you know, Keogh got off to a pretty slow start in Colorado, but man, he's really turned it up recently. And we know the kind of impact he can make when he's on in the playoffs. So if he's gonna be playing like this, that's huge for Colorado, who I think, unfortunately, Dallas, like New Jersey, another team that's maybe just too banged up now, with Haskinen still out and now Jason Robertson out as well. You know, pretty unfortunate timing for them.
I picked the Avs to win. I think Brian did too.
Yeah, I picked them to win because of the injury issues. I mean, that's like the Bruins.
No, I mean everything, like win it all.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I picked the Avs to win everything, yes. Yeah, but Dallas going into the series would be similar to the Bruins entering a series without McAvoy and Pastrnak and then playing against like a fully loaded Leafs team or something, just to kind of do a division comparison. But yeah, it's tough. It's tough when you don't have that elite player when you go into a matchup like that, because you would have Mikko Rantanen going up against the Avs and a fully loaded Stars team. Just so much potential heading into that series, but of course, injuries remain undefeated, unfortunately. But all right, and yeah, the point on Coyle, Scott. Good for him. I mean, it's all about fit. Boston wanted him to be something here because of their current roster makeup, that he succeeded in the regular season in 23-24, but it wasn't a sustainable recipe. And obviously he goes to Colorado and he's just a piece there. He is a piece. He's not somebody who's relied upon to be a top 4 or 5 offensive producer for them. So good for Charlie Coyle, and yeah, if things go the way that I predicted in my bracket, he'll be lifting the Stanley Cup, and that'll be great to see for him. The odds of a former Bruin winning the Cup this year, pretty high. I mean, you have Carlo in Toronto, you have Coyle in Colorado, Freddie's in Edmonton, Marchand's in Florida, Brazo is in Minnesota. That's less of a probability. Montgomery's
in St. Louis.
Yeah, Mozzie's in St. Louis.
Cassidy's in Vegas.
And, you know,
Sagan's in Dallas.
Yeah.
Well, I was more so talking former Bruins from this year, but yeah.
Montgomery still counts then. So.
Yeah, he does. He does. Sometimes I'll see people comment that all these former Bruins from this year are now in the playoffs and the Bruins aren't. But as it's like, well, yeah, obviously.
Right. They that was them. The point. Like, they weren't going to make it, so they traded guys to teams that were going. Like, but yeah, people, that was the whole equation. That's exactly what happened.
People will phrase that as if it's just not what was meant to be. It's like, of course that's what happened. That's what you do when you sell.
Yeah. I think anyway. We're going to touch on Montgomery with one of the mailbag questions too. So,
well, let's get into it right now. Let's go to Kelly, who emailed us. And she has a couple of points. She says that Pasternak should be the captain after this season. More of a statement, less of a question. Kelly, I think the three of us agree with you on that, but there's obviously a case to be made for Charlie. She says they must sign Morgan Geekie. What is that contract going to look like? And to that, I prompt you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's earned real term and real money. You know, someone asked me on Twitter, I think like last week, and I think the tweet was something like 5x6 or 6x5. And I basically said, like, that seems like it's in the right neighborhood to me. Like, 5 or 6 years, $5 to $6 million a year, feels like what he's played himself into. And like, especially with the cap going up, like, it's probably going to get a little bit more than maybe, you know, people would have anticipated a month or two ago. And again, he's only 26. So I wouldn't really be worried about the years. Like, you get him through his prime years into his early 30s. I looked up so The Athletic has like player cards that include, you know, they're like analytics based cards of players. And part of it is they have like their market value, essentially what they're worth in the eyes of this analytical formula that The Athletic has. And they have Morgan Geekie's market value at $8 million. So, you know, he's not going to get that. Because that does feel a little high, and also he's a restricted free agent, so that should keep it down a little. But yeah, I think it's definitely going to go over $5 million a year.
Can I make a comp here to somebody that the Bruins previously had in their top six, Jake DeBrusque? Like, just look at his contract and see, like, do our listeners, does our audience think that Morgan Geekie is better than Jake DeBrusque? I feel like the answer is probably yes, and the stats would bear that out. DeBrusque's 82 games played this year, 48 points with Vancouver. Geekie career year, 77 games played, 57 points with the Bruins. DeBrusque's contract is 5.5 a year. And I'm not sure how long it is. I think it's like 5 or 6 years. It's a 7-year contract. So do you think he should be getting Jake DeBrusque money? Like, do you think he should be in that range?
Whether it's with Boston or somebody else, I absolutely think so. I mean, if that's the case, yes. And like,
5.5, 7 years sound well. Good, so to the people, or
I'm less sure on term. I'm personally not somebody that's good at projecting like what somebody's term should be. But if we're talking just the AAV, like that AAV sounds very, very fair.
Yeah, and again, like, it's also RFA versus UFA. Like, yeah. DeBrusque is unrestricted, so he's more likely to get max term, because if there's any sort of market, then that's probably what a team has to go to in order to sign him.
And I will say, just because we're talking about like length of contract, Morgan Geekie's 26, so obviously age factors into how long of a contract you're gonna give someone. So either way, like a 5 to 6 year contract, he's still in his prime. 7 year contract, he's still pretty much in his prime for most of it, maybe not the last year or so, but yeah, I think that those are comps that you can make. And if you look at Morgan Geekie, what he's been able to do in Boston compared to Jake DeBrusque in Boston, I think you'd find that he's been able to progress to maybe what people hoped Jake DeBrus would have been able to do at some point, but Morgan Geekie's actually been able to do it, and obviously he has a slightly different role. But his role has adapted because he's gotten better and he's been able to prove that he could play in not just in the top six, but on the top line. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring up that comparison.
It's a good one. It's a good one, Bridget. I think DeBrus in 22-23, had he not gotten hurt for a couple of months, I think he was probably tracking for somewhere in the mid-60s in points, maybe something like that. So had he played that full slate, maybe he would have had that notch to his belt. But let me ask you guys a question, because I want to illustrate something here. Scott, give me a hypothetical AAV and term contract for Morgan Geekie that you think is fair and, you know, would do well for both sides.
Five years, $6 million a year.
Okay. Well, in 3 years, and nothing is set in stone, so take this with a grain of salt, but 3 years from now, the NHL salary cap is projected to be $113 million a year. So what is $6 million for somebody that is at that stage, 29 years old, that is producing, let's call it 45 to 55 points at a $6 million cap hit, right? It's just, and the cap is expected to be around 95 next year and then into the hundreds in the year after, and then eventually 113. So I'm just not, there's a certainly a dollar value where you're going to be, where I would say, yeah, that's not worth it for Morgan Geekie. I just don't know if I'm ready to say that for $6 million when the cap is projected to go up the way that it is. And we know, listen, outside of October and November of this past season, he's been pretty damn good in Boston. And that spans across times where he wasn't playing with David Pastrnak. In the 23-24 season, he had 39 points. Probably 60 to 70% of those came in a third line role. Towards the end of the year, he was bumped up to the Pastrnak line, and then we all know what happened this year. So we're talking about a guy that over the course of two seasons now, for 85, 90% of that time, has been a good, solid player.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
It's no surprise that facial hair is personal. It grows from your face. Whether you're going smooth shaven or maintaining a beard, Dollar Shave Club offers shave and grooming products that are always high quality, but never overpriced. Visit dollarshaveclub.com and use promo code SHAVEUP for 20% off $20 or more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Baseball's all about the games, and the best in daily gaming is on the MLB app, where every day starts with new puzzles and challenges. Test your skills with MLB Pickle, the ultimate mystery player challenge, and Immaculate Grid, where stats and strategy collide, or chase the $5.6 million jackpot jackpot and beat the streak, presented by BetMGM. And for an all-new spin on fantasy sports, there's Spinball, the game's official home for games, is on the MLB app. MLB trademarks used with permission. No purchase necessary. Restrictions apply. For official rules, go to MLB.com/play/official rules.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray.
We are friends and reality dating show fans, and the only thing we love as much as love stories is lovingly snarking on them.
Whether you love love or love to hate it, listen to Love to See It, our podcast dissecting all the romance we see on screen.
From reality dating shows like The Bachelor and Love is Blind to classic rom-coms like You've Got Mail, we recap in obsessive detail and unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
Listen to Love to See It on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and like last year, it was also a little bit of a slow start for him and then kind of picked up. So, you know, that is one thing he's going to have to figure out. Like, got to start the season on time, especially, you know, if you get paid. But yeah, I mean, December 1st on, he was tied for fourth in the NHL in goals. Like, you know, if that player is going to the open market, he's getting even more than 5 to 6. Like, someone's probably splurging for $7 million for him. So, look, they basically already made the decision on him, right? When they didn't trade him away at the deadline, yeah, technically you could trade him now. But as we've said before, like, you already have enough holes up front. You don't want to go trading away Morgan Geeky and creating another one, because all things considered, like, he is probably going to be the most affordable option you can find for someone who can play with David Pastrnak. And he's someone you already know can play with him. Instead of just, you know, okay, well, we're going to let Geeky go and we're going to sign so-and-so that we think is a little bit, you know, we're going to go sign Nick Ehlers, who we think is a better, more complete player than Geeky. We're going to give him $8 million a year and then put him with Pastrnak. And, like, then you risk, you know, getting a couple months into the year and be like, ah, man, Pastrnak and Ehlers really haven't clicked the way we were hoping, right? Just like Pastrnak and Elias Lindholm didn't really click right away the way we were hoping. It's like, Pastrnak and Geeky already have chemistry. Don't overthink it. Re-sign Geeky, keep them together, add to your lineup outside of that.
Yeah, and again, to your point, the counter argument that you will hear all the time is, he's producing because of Pastrnak, and Pastrnak should be playing with higher caliber players than Morgan Geeky. But were people saying that in 2022-23 when Pavel Zacha was an unknown, more or less an unknown to the casual Bruins fan before coming to Boston? Like, or like, where was that rhetoric then? Zacha wasn't some proven NHL scorer at that point in his career. So I sometimes feel like people, there's a lot of things to justifiably bitch about and complain about with this Bruins team over the last calendar year. I just don't think this is one of those times where people are scratching and clawing to complain about potentially re-signing Geeky because he's only good with Pastrnak. Well, that's not entirely true. We talked about it. He's been in a third line role in Boston without Pasta and has done well. But also, last time I checked, Pastrnak's not going anywhere. So what's the concern?
And also, unfortunately, this was kind of a wasted season for the production of that line. But if this was a year that they made the playoffs, and they made the playoffs because that line was so good, you're not saying that about Morgan Geeky. You're not like, oh, you know, you're like, wow, it worked. All right, we're watching this line click and these two players in particular click, and it's creating, you know, positive results for us in terms of making it to the playoffs, maybe going deeper in the playoffs. Like, if it was on a team that it would have made a difference, because that line was the one line that was continuing to do it, especially at the end of the season when after the trade deadline, when a lot of the other guys were traded away. So I think in a different situation, maybe the perspective on him would have been a little bit different, because what he was doing would have actually meant something and towards a playoff berth or even maybe some points in the playoffs that were important.
Yeah. One last point I would make here is also, like, yeah, of course, Morgan Geeky benefited from being on a line with Pastrnak. Duh. But also, like, guys learn things and grow when they're playing with good players. Like, they start to see the game different. They start to think the game different. And as an example, I would use Riley Smith. a player who, when he was here, everyone said, the only reason he's doing anything is because he's playing on line with Bergeron and Marchand, and you can just put anyone there and they'll be fine. And Riley Smith, it turns out, went on to just have a really solid career. It was just a really solid middle six winger for the next 8-9 years and helps Vegas win a Stanley Cup. And it's like, yeah, it turns out, yes, he benefited from playing with Bergeron and Marchand, but he also got better as a player and then stayed a good player even when he wasn't playing with those guys anymore. So, like, Geeky, even if you move him off of the line with Pasternak at some point, if he's picked up enough good habits and kind of learned enough, like, he'll be a better player on another line than he was last year or 2 years ago.
Well, and also, and please, if you're listening or if you're watching, please don't mistake what I'm about to say for comparing Morgan Geeky to Brad Marchand. But Brad Marchand himself, right? When he comes up into the NHL, he gets put next to Patrice Bergeron after working his way off that fourth line. And Brad Marchand turned into an all-time Bruin. You don't think Patrice Bergeron had something to do with that? And that Bergeron, like, Marchand became the player he was over time. Now, I'm not saying that's Morgan Geeky. I'm just illustrating to Scott's point, you're allowed to have teammates build you up and turn you into something that maybe you weren't when you first broke into the league. That's all I'm saying.
Even, like, think about Chara's role in developing some of the other defensemen, like the younger defensemen
Carlo and McAvoy both start their careers with him.
Yeah, I don't think McAvoy's the same player if he doesn't learn from Chara early on. Like, I feel like there was a lot of learning that happened and a lot of growth that happened when he was alongside him. So,
tying up a few loose ends for Kelly, she asked about Hampus Lindholm's availability next year. Hampus did say at breakup day that he will be back next year. In fact, he'll be skating in a matter of weeks here. So that is not a hole that the Bruins are going to have to fill roster-wise. And then Bridget, hold on to that bag of popcorn. Kelly says that Scott signed is going to be worth a lot someday.
I'm going to go grab it. Just so people can see it up close, okay? So this is the aforementioned popcorn box that I made him sign on the last day. It says, Scott McLaughlin, keep on popping. That was the second take, because the first take was this monstrosity.
God knows what that says.
That's a celebrity signature.
Wow.
That's scribbles.
Yeah.
Hashtag chicken scratch.
That's what you got to do. I mean, you're rifling through hundreds of autographs over the course of a day. Like, you don't have time to write me.
Yeah, you're right. Yep. This was Scott's first ever autograph, and it took two takes, but he got it eventually after I pestered him and said, I'm going to put it in the background of the podcast. Please do a better job. Thank you.
No one can read it way back there on your mantle anyways.
But everybody knows what it is now. So,
well, you've added some nice memorabilia and apparel to your background this year, Bridget. You've got the Hockey East jacket that your friend made.
Yes, there's the jacket right here.
There's a jacket. Yeah, that's pretty sick.
Genius jackets. He's actually just made Pat Maroon's retirement jacket. He made Marchand's 1,000-game jacket. He makes a lot of the jackets for all the hockey players. If you see it, a nice jacket. That's probably him. I have this puck right here. This is the Scott's face puck. There's like a little snow globe the Bruins gave us. There's the Bobby Orr.
Is that Scott's face photo cropped into the Bobby Orr picture? Diving for the goal against St. Louis?
See, that's where people would, I would lose people on that.
That's just taking it a little too far, Bridget. You know, the hockey
Should
puck.
Should I put his face on all of the players in the Beanpot poster?
Yeah.
Exactly. People don't realize that Bobby Orr wasn't actually tripped. He skated over a popcorn kernel.
God. Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Sometimes I regret feeding into this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Kim, you sent us in the question via email, and here it is. She says, since the Bruins pretty much gave everyone a call up from Providence, why was Michael DiPietro never given a chance to mind the net in an NHL game? That made no sense to me. One of your most important positions on the team, impending UFA, see what you have, see what you have essentially, and it wouldn't hurt the team if you lost because it would only help your draft positioning. Is Michael DiPietro a player you two hoped to have seen get an opportunity sometime down the stretch?
So I was not clamoring for that, and I have no problem with them not giving him a look. My main reason being, and I know we're going to have a question about Corpusalo coming up, but Jonas Corpusalo didn't play enough this year as it was. So if there were games that you weren't going to play Jeremy Swayman down the stretch, whether that was performance or rest or just normal days off, like, I kind of think it had to be Corpusalo playing. Like, he earned the playing time. You're paying him $3 million. I don't really see where there was an opportunity to give DiPietro a game, because I think any game that Swayman wasn't playing, Corpusalo deserved.
Yeah, it didn't even cross my mind, because I mean, we had talked about it over the course of the season, is Corpusalo being underused, and there was a report that he wasn't happy with the amount of playing time he got, which would be understandable, because...
Well, he said as much on breakup day. Like,
Yeah, but he said it in a very, like, subtle, polite way. Not like a, hey, what the hell kind of way. It was kind of like, well, yeah, every goalie wants to play more. Like, it was said in a nice kind of blanket way. Though, you know, that behind that is probably a lot more frustration than he was putting off in his tone. And he only got a little bit under 30% of the starts, which, 70-30 is a big difference in a split, especially when, you know, he has to be thinking, well, could I even be doing that, like, different or better to get into the net, when it seems like if it was a true competition, when Swayman played worse, Corpusalo would get more chances. But that's not what happened. So certainly a lot of goalie duos, tandems, whatever, it's predicated on, or at least there's a base understanding of, like, hey, you will have a chance if you're playing better hockey. But that's really not what the system was in Boston this year, because the contract that Swayman got, because they promised Swayman to get a certain amount of games and they gave him 70% of the starts, like I mentioned before. So it just felt like there was no room for upward growth, and that can be really frustrating.
So why don't I tie in that question that Scott was alluding to about Corpusalo from CJ? If Corpusalo is not back next year, do you envision DiPietro or Bussy as the backup? Or will they try and get someone already NHL tested? So let me just add to CJ's question here. Do you think it's likely the Bruins try to move on from Corpusalo? And if they do, should it be Bussy, DiPietro, or other?
I think they'll see if there's any bites. If anyone's interested in trading for him, because if someone's willing to take on his contract, that's $3 million off the book. That now, obviously, like, you know, say it's DiPietro's the backup, he's going to get $900,000. So you're not really freeing up $3 million, you're freeing up 2.1. But that's 2.1 that can help you add elsewhere. That said, I don't really imagine there's going to be much of a market for Corpusalo. Like, I mean, he was... Like, let's not go crazy with the season he had. Like, he was okay. He was still below average in most statistical metrics. So it's not like he was like Anthony Stolarz in Florida last year, where you're like, wow, that guy put up some damn good numbers as a backup. Like, maybe someone should give him a shot as a starter. And now he's Toronto's starter in the playoffs. Like, Corpusalo's not doing that. And he has a track record of not being outside of really one and a half seasons, like, not being an especially good NHL goalie. So I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of a market. My guess is he's back next year as the backup again. But if he were gone, yeah, I think DiPietro is a guy you'd bring back and, you know, probably give that opportunity to, or at least have him compete with, you know, some veteran, cheap veteran X. I don't know who that is, but maybe someone you bring in who could either be your backup or go down to the AHL if they clear waivers.
All right, let's move on to a question from Mark, who emailed us and said, my question has to do with the center position for the Bruins next year, and specifically why Matt Patra has been written off. I've listened to endless podcasts and weekend shows, and in the past few weeks, it seems
they talked about our weekend show.
I think probably just in general, generally speaking.
There is a Saturday show on the other channel as well, so maybe that show. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. So Mark's listening to podcasts and shows, and basically says that it seems as though the tide has turned and a majority of writers and on-air talent have made the decision that Elias Lindholm, Casey Mittelstadt, Fraser Minton, and Mark Kastelic are locks for the center position next year. Why is that? So, Bridget and Scott, you know, we've talked about it a little bit. There is a bit of a logjam at the center ice position as it pertains to players who are capable of playing center NHL minutes at center ice. And obviously the Bruins, in all likelihood, are probably going to, not guaranteed, they're probably going to draft a center prospect in the first round this year. Not that that player will be NHL ready this year, but certainly into the future. And that could be complicated with somebody like Matt Patra. Do they try to add somebody via trade or free agency? Really, nobody knows. But Mark mentions the names that are in town right now that we know of. And he's right. It does seem like Elias Lindholm, Casey Mittelstadt, Fraser Minton, Mark Kastelic, hell, even Pavel Zacha's name, who he didn't mention, is in the fold. But you don't hear Matt Patra as much, and he has been killing it down in Providence. So I don't know if people are writing him off. I just think sometimes when you're out of sight, out of mind at the NHL level, people tend to forget what one's doing down in Providence. And to Mark's point, he's been killing it. So do you guys feel that Patra's name is not being talked about as much for next year?
Yeah, probably to an extent. I don't think we've done that. You know, I'm certainly not writing off Patra. Like, I think I've said, put him in a competition. You know, if he wins a job out of camp, give him the job. I think the Bruins are at this point pretty clearly taking a quantity approach to trying to figure out the center position, where they're going to throw a lot of bodies at it, and whoever wins a job gets one. And, you know, I would push back on the idea that anything's settled. Like, yeah, we think we can probably safely say Elias Lindholm's going to center a line. He has never really played wing. He's not getting traded. So Elias Lindholm's one of your centers. Mark Kastelic played both center and wing, so he could be either position. Zacha can play either. Casey Mittelstadt, I remain fascinated by, because he just did not have a very good season in Colorado or Boston. I do think he needed better line mates in Boston. So, you know, he's not a player who's going to single-handedly drive a line and drag along two AHL wingers. So I'd like to see him with better line mates. But still, like, just think his game left quite a bit to be desired down the stretch. So I'm not locking him in as like a clear part of the team. We've talked about him as a potential trade option if the Bruins just decide, hey, you know what? We don't really like what we're seeing. Fraser Minton's only 20 years old. Like, he might need more AHL time. So, I'm not writing Patra or anyone else off. Like, Mark also mentioned later in his email, Don Zoshmelis, who's off to a great start in Providence with 12 points in six games while playing on a line with Patra. And I think it's been Zoshmelis more at left wing with Patra at center. But, like, that's another guy who, hey, if this is what Zoshmelis is going to do as a pro, and he has a really good playoffs for Providence, like, throw him in the mix as well. That feels like it would be a little ahead of schedule to me, but who knows? Like, I don't know, maybe he proves to be ready.
Yeah, he's a center. I mean, he played center at UMass, and he was good at it, and he was a good face-off guy. Obviously, it's at a different level, but he won a lot of face-offs. He goes to the net well. He's fast. He's crafty. He's another guy that could be there. Also, don't rule out the possibility that Patra is playing wing, right? Not just the other way around, that other guys would get moved. Like, he could end up on the wing as well. So that's something to keep an eye on. I think the reason why you hear less of a conversation about Patra in the mix of when people have been talking about potential lines for next year is because he's been away in Providence. So kind of out of sight, out of mind, maybe for people who were just kind of caught up in talking about the guys that had gotten called up, which would mean they were talking about Mitten and mean that they were talking about Mittelstadt after the trade deadline and just talking about other options because that's who is in front of them at the end of the season. That's obviously just what the roster looked like. And I think when you do look at Patra's numbers in Providence, they've been good. They've been really good. And Lishmalis as well, he's played 6 games. He's got 12 points. So since coming out of college, he's fit right in. And obviously they're beginning their playoffs now. So certainly more to keep an eye on of guys on the Providence roster. I think all three of us would agree that we've not written off Patra. I think we all were probably in unison saying, like, at different points in the season, oh, call him back up and or like, oh, he deserves a spot over XYZ other player, or he could make a difference on your offense just as a playmaker. I don't think we've ever said anything like that. I think a lot of people, if they're writing him off, it has to do with his size a lot of the time. And just seeing how physical contact in the NHL sometimes was a little bit overwhelming for him. Is there still time for him to put on weight? Yes. Can his other abilities overcome some of that stuff if he's just smarter than, you know, outsmarting people and making better plays? We'll see. So certainly too early to write him off. He's still young. He's 21. And I think Mitten is 20. So those are two young centers that hopefully, I mean, battle it out. That's kind of the same. They're kind of both vying for the same spot if you really look at it. If you think that those guys are both, at this point, early on in their career, going to come in and be third-line centers, that's two guys fighting for the same spot. Maybe they end up on the same line with one of them as a winger. Like, you have a young third line or something like that. But we'll see. That's a big training camp topic of conversation for sure.
Yeah, and essentially it just comes down to you can't play in the NHL if you can't stay healthy in the NHL. And that's kind of a point that Bridget brought up in the later stages there, which is he physically just he takes a couple of hits and whether it's a shoulder or this or that, whatever, you have to be able to endure the strength of NHL players. And that's, again, that's strength and conditioning. And that's something that can be improved upon through, you know, off ice work. As far as on ice ability, Matt Patra is absolutely not written off by anybody who's making decisions in Boston. I can promise you that. And certainly not by us. I think it comes down to there's going to be job openings. May the best player win those openings. And to the points you guys have made, If you have a strong enough camp and you're forcing coaches and management to make a decision on you to keep you there, and it's not your natural position, but they'd rather not send you down, they'll find a spot for you because there is a lot of versatility among all these players. A lot of the guys can play multiple positions, like you guys have mentioned. I want to circle back to something CJ said because it had to do with Patra's usage in Providence. And the question is, do you think they never brought Patra back up from Providence because he was – at 66 games, and Sweeney did not want him to be a waiver exempt by giving him the additional 14 games. Scott, this sounds like it's your territory more so than certainly mine. Bridget, you're probably knowledgeable on this, but I know Scott has this stuff down pat.
Yeah, so Patra would not have gotten there this year because I think his age and years as a pro, it's still like 160 games he would have needed to become a waivers eligible player, meaning he would need waivers to be sent down. But next year it drops down to 80. So I do think maybe part of this calculation was let's give ourselves a little wiggle room where next year they'll have, I think, 14 games to play with. Or what is he at now? 60? Something. I forget what the number was. 66. Yeah, so 14 games to play with next year where, and like, he could start the year in the NHL they get 10 games in, say, he still needs a little bit of seasoning, send him down without waivers. So, yeah, it's just a reality of the business and managing a salary cap team is, you know, you have to take things like that into consideration. Roster flexibility, waiver eligibility, all of that stuff. So, yeah, I'm sure to some extent, you know, now look, if they had brought him up for three games at the end, does that really hurt them? Like, no, they still would have had 11 games to play with.
Doesn't really help them that much either, though. Like, it's
right. So I'm sure to some extent it was part of the calculation.
All right, we got about 15-20 minutes left, guys. I want to try to get to at least two or three more of these. Again, thank you all very much for submitting your questions. We really do appreciate it. So let's go to Jeff. And Jeff asked, what did you guys think of the Charlie Jacobs throwing Monty under the bus in the Globe? After the way the rest of the season went, why still try to make Monty the scapegoat? I'll just add some color here. This was alluding to a comment that Charlie Jacobs made about how training camp was disjointed and disorganized, lack of structure. I believe we might have the full quote that we're going to grab.
Yeah, I'll read the full quote because it's probably more, you know, people may have seen it or heard it by now, but I think it is worth reading in full, even though it's a little bit longer. So this is Charlie Jacobs to Jim McBride in the Boston Globe, pointing to a rough training camp as like the root of their early season struggles, said, I feel it was a little bit disorganized. There was a real lack of structure. You see teams to come through. They have a system. They have perhaps a fallback play, a breakout play, something. And when I watched the Boston Bruins start the season, it was just chaos. There was no organization, and I had a difficult time understanding that given Monty's record. I don't know how to answer that other than to say something just changed. And at that point, you've shopped for the groceries. You've made the meal at this point. What are you going to do? Monty didn't necessarily have any answers, and at that point, we had to make a decision.
Have they said you shopped for the groceries? Like Monty?
No, he's saying that the Bruins shopped for the group. Like they had their roster. They had their guys. Nothing was going to change on that front.
Gotcha. At first, I thought they were saying like, you know, he made these decisions on who to bring in. And
no, I don't think so. I didn't read it like that.
Okay. Well, it wouldn't make sense like that anyway. So let's just pretend that there's no confusion about that. That he's talking about what Don Sweeney brought in. And then what Monty needed to work with. So, they were disorganized coming out of camp for sure. I'm a little, like, I have issue with saying that was completely on him. It seemed like he tried a lot of different things. Maybe we go back and watch some early season Bruins to like relive the pain. I don't know. And see like, yeah, they were bad at getting out of their own end. They defensively had a lot of breakdowns. Like, is that all on Monty or is that execution? Like what was the game plan? Like how much was Charlie Jacobs talking to Montgomery about his plans and like them not working?
Well, so I do think like some of this is clearly, I gotta imagine it's Charlie Jacobs filtered through Don Sweeney. I mean, listen, maybe Charlie Jacobs is more of a hockey mind than we think, but like, I don't know how much he's paying attention to systems and fallback plays and breakout plays. Like that feels like something that kind of gets filtered up to him from Don Sweeney.
I don't think it's all that in depth.
Yeah, but that said, like Montgomery had tried a lot of different things because they had a bad camp. And like we talked about it at the time, that's not revisionist history. Like this was like we were reporting on this and talking about it like before camp was over. We were like, these practices don't look right.
So the three of us were in the street level of Warrior when Bridget was on her crutches and we were the three of us were saying how there was no pace and no urgency to the camp.
That was like 4 or 5 days into camp, like, and you could like already see it. So Yeah, I mean, some of it is, as we also covered, like some of it was injuries. You know, Marchand missed the first half of camp. Elias Lindholm missed a week or maybe even a little more.
Coyle was a little banged up potentially.
Coyle was a little banged up. Like, so that's part of it, but
Wayman wasn't there, obviously.
Of course, that's a huge one. But yeah, no, the practices just didn't seem to be run in an effective way. So like, this has been obviously a pretty common topic on Boston Sports Radio since this interview came out. And I see people like ripping Charlie Jacobs because it's like, well, why is he still trying to blame Montgomery? Like, look how the rest of the season went, which is fair. But I also think he was kind of just answering a question and not saying anything different than what a lot of us saw. Like, they had a bad training camp, and it's on the head coach to run a training camp. Like, that is his job. So if it doesn't go well and the team's disjointed and not ready to start the season, it is 1,000% fair to point fingers at the coach.
Well, so, okay. So to the crux of Jeff's question, which is, because let's be honest, Charlie Jacobs absolutely threw Jim Montgomery under the bus with that statement, whether he meant to or not, it's what the result was. And so the question is, how do we feel about what he did, why he did that? I am not absolving Jim Montgomery's responsibility as head coach to make sure that your team is ready to go out of the gates. And if there was any sour grapes from Monty behind the scenes about roster construction, lack of contract negotiation, or lack of contract execution for him, I'm sure there were things behind the scenes that Monty was looking around and maybe there was a little bit of sour grapes. Maybe he wasn't feeling it in the moment. Maybe he wasn't giving it his all. Whether that was conscious or not, right? But so that's Monty's blame. But I think the point here is, why is he the only one that Charlie Jacobs is calling out? Why is Charlie Jacobs not holding the players themselves accountable? Why is he not holding the GM accountable? Why is he not holding himself accountable for what is a team sport? It's a team sport when you win, when you lose, when you perform, when you don't. So I think the issue people have here is, we all saw that the training camp sucked, and we all know that there was multiple reasons for it. Scott mentioned them: different injuries, different this, different that. Why was Monty the only one called out? My opinion is that I think the Bruins are a little bit PO'd still at just how quick of a turnaround it was for Monty to sign with St. Louis. And I think that there's probably no love lost there when it comes to how that played out. Now, you can sit there and say, well, Charlie, you should have given the guy what he wanted if you didn't want to lose him. It's all fair game. But if you're asking me why do I think Charlie Jacobs was so quick to throw Monty under the bus, I think that probably has a little something to do with it.
And we talked about this at the time of their struggles and knowing that Monty didn't have an extension. Like, does a lame duck coach differently than a guy who feels secure and has a contract? Also, to go back to the shopping for the groceries, like, part of it, well, who's to say that, you know, you blame Monty 100% for Lindholm getting off to a slow start when it was a combination of him still trying to catch up from camp, probably still dealing with some lingering pain or you know, difficulties in some way from the back injury that it was that he had to miss time for in camp. And also maybe for Don Sweeney for not putting together a top six that worked exactly how he envisioned it when it came in. So it always comes across as scapegoating the coach, a guy that you have already decided to move on from, rather than put the blame on people that are still around that you plan on keeping around, like saying Don Sweeney and Elias Lindholm and like players who get off to slow starts. Like, those guys are still here, so you're not going to say something about them. Can you easily go after Monty, who's no longer with you and doesn't matter what you, yes, you can do that. So,
Yeah, and on the lame duck thing too, I will say, like, this is why you don't go into a season with the lame duck coach. And they, in retrospect, they really should have made a decision on Montgomery way ahead of then. Like, after last season, either you're extending him because you think he's the right coach, or if you're already having doubts at that point about whether you want to extend him or whether, you know, you want to give him the contract he's looking for, if you're already having those doubts, you know, at the start of the summer when you're talking to him, then rip the Band-Aid off. Like, move on, because you're just setting yourself up for a situation where you're looking at firing him somewhere down the line. And in their case, that's exactly what they did. So, I think that was a mistake, you know, letting that linger into the season. And yeah, I do think they're still frustrated about how quickly he ended up in St. Louis, because it does give off the appearance that, or it at least makes you question, like, did he have a foot out the door because he knew St. Louis was waiting? It wasn't really much of a secret that St. Louis liked him. We talked about it, how, you know, they waited to extend, why am I blanking on the coach they fired to bring Monty in? But that they waited to sign him to an extension until the Bruins got past Toronto. Like, they were waiting to see if Monty was available, and everyone kind of knew that. So, I'm sure there's lingering hard feelings there. Brian's fighting his microphone.
Brian is in a war with his mic, so I will read the next question. I will read the next one. All right. This one is from Brooke, who I'm not sure.
This is a more competitive battle than like 70% of the playoff games over the weekend.
He's just like, can't get, I don't know. Did you fix it?
He definitely did not fix it.
I can't hear you, so the mic is still winning. All right, I'm going to read Brooke's question while Brian figures that out. Brooke says, Torontonian here, but a diehard Bruins fan since the Bork days. Love your show. After watching the breakup day pod, do you think Swayman will become the Aaron Rodgers of hockey with all of the strange nature references and seemingly large, albeit possibly misplaced, ego? So this one, I have maybe a different perspective on it than other people. There weren't a lot of people around when this answer was given. It was, so like the context maybe around it is a little bit misunderstood. I think it was just me and Adam Pellerin and the Nesson cameraman who were there at the time when I asked the question. And I didn't take it as like, so Aaron Rodgers is an extreme, right? Like, Aaron Rodgers is somebody who has tried like ayahuasca therapy and a lot of different
darkness retreats.
Yeah, like I'm gonna call them like quack medical things. I don't know, because I don't understand them. I'm not sure if they're really considered to be of the highest medical standard for results or whatever. I think he's kind of in the extreme, and I think Swayman is just like an outdoorsy person. So like, I think there's a difference between being like, I want to be one with nature, like in an extreme sense, versus like, he grew up with the perspective of like, I'm just a person in the world, and like, whatever I do isn't a huge deal. You know what I mean? Like, he used the word gratitude a lot, perspective. Like, I think he just grew up in Alaska, in the outdoors, and that's just kind of what he talks about and what he probably grew up talking about. I don't know. I'm not from Alaska. Maybe I have to phone an Alaskan on this. Is this how people up there talk all the time? But like I said, I was one of the only people around, and I got like a very different impression of like, do I think he needed to bring up nature? No, but it was kind of wholesome. And it was just like, you know, maybe a little bit hippie-ish, but not like full on Aaron Rodgers. Who is the other person that people were comparing him to the other day?
Well, Tristan Casas came up.
That was Brian.
Kyrie Irving. Like,
absolutely would not go as far as to any of the other guys. Even Tristan Casas, who he is way more out in public talking, like daily. out here talking about like this getting energy from the sun and the ground, and like it's not even in my mind, it's not even close. Like he's just maybe like that one friend in the friend group who talks a little bit too much about nature, but it's really just a normal person. He just really likes being outside, and yeah, I think it's his upbringing in Alaska that has a lot to do with it. So yeah, I would not go there.
Yeah, and again, like if he plays well, then no one cares. Then it almost becomes endearing if he's one of the best goalies in the NHL and he almost single-handedly carries you to a playoff victory like he did last spring when he was also saying weird stuff and yet was the most popular athlete in Boston. Now, because he had a bad season, it's annoying and everyone hates it. And like, I get that. That's the nature of being sports fans and media. You know, we get fed up with guys who don't perform, and you latch on to the weird quirks of guys who do perform. So, yeah, like I get why it doesn't play super well in Boston, because like we're not really that kind of city, right? Like Boston's all about like blue collar hard work, especially Bruins fans. That's how they see themselves. So yeah, when you hear like nature and spirituality and all that, people's eyes glaze over. Like it's not really what we're interested in. So
that probably plays well in like California and Oregon and Alaska.
Oh
like,
yeah, put him on the Anaheim Ducks and he's a superstar.
Yeah. Yeah. So, oh no.
Yeah, Brian still doesn't fix his mic, so
it's still red, so I'm guessing that's not good. All right. Hope.
Yeah, I was gonna say, do we want to just do one more and wrap up?
Yeah. He's screaming at it.
This is gonna be an extra entertaining YouTube, because not only do you get the podcast, but you get Brian fighting his microphone.
Brian screaming in the background at his microphone.
It's gonna come back right when Brian drops like the loudest F-bomb he's ever dropped.
And it's a new mic, so, and he's had issues with it quite a bit since he got it. All right, we'll go to one more. We do have a few more left. Which we will save, because we're going to have plenty of time, and we touched on a lot of different things. So
yeah, we have a lot more off season than usual. So keep sending us questions.
2 months more.
Yeah, we're gonna need to do a lot of mailbags.
Yes, I'm gonna go to this one. This is a player that was talked about at the beginning of the podcast. We're talking about Mitch Marner. We got a question on Twitter from MarshawnFan63. He says, would the Leafs trade Nylander to the Bruins in order to sign Marner? Nylander and Pasta are buddies, and I think that they would be great. He'd be great to fill the right wing void with Mittelstadt and Zacha on the second line. So, logistically is where there's one like right off the bat big issue with this working out, like how this is explained. So, the biggest issue is that Mitch Marner is going to be able to choose whatever team he wants. So if he really wants to stay with Toronto, then that's one thing. But I get the sense that he wants to go just pick somewhere else. Like, it's up to where he wants to land. First and foremost, with him as a free agent, he has a lot of control. So if you wanted to do something like this, you would have had to have done it probably the offseason last year. Timing-wise, I don't think that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like the motivation here, if you're Toronto and even considering something like this, is you hate to lose Mitch Marner for nothing, which obviously looks like there's a decent chance they're going to. So do you trade Nylander instead, presumably get a ton in return, and then pay Marner, and like now you kind of have, I'm not going to say the best of both worlds, but like at least you've gotten something for one of your stars. You know, obviously the Leafs weren't in position to trade Marner at the deadline or anything. Like, they're trying to win a cup. So of course they're going to hold on to Marner. I guess they could have, like, right. I mean, Colorado made a decision on Rantanen and traded him, but the Leafs chose a different path. They chose to wait and just kind of see it through with Marner. So I get what the motivation could potentially be for this, but I don't really see it happening. I think that they probably like Nylander more than Marner. Just in terms of like competitiveness, he's more of a goal scorer. Maybe competitiveness isn't the right word, but Nylander has kind of stepped up vocally at times and challenged some of the other leaders of that group. So it feels to me like they already sort of made the decision when they signed Nylander of like, yeah, this is a guy we're committing to, even if it means we lose Marner somewhere down the line. So I don't know. I don't really see that happening. To me, Marner's more likely to be gone and find a new team.
Well, and also that it's too late really to do that, right? Like the timeline would.
Well, no, they can do it after the season.
I mean, yeah, but they would have, but I'm saying the timeline is past for them to like offer Marner an extension before.
Well, they have till July 1st.
I mean, so you're right. I guess they could. My thought is that because they haven't offered him an extension yet.
Oh, they've offered him an extension. They just
or come to an agreement on an extension yet. Yeah. That he's not necessarily trying to land back there. And that
well, if you offer $14 million, if you offer what he wants, I think his interest in re-signing goes up. So
probably so, but he certainly wants to look around the market. I think so.
I'm back.
He's back.
And I'm back.
And that's the end of the podcast.
No. I'm back. Thank you all for listening. Now, listen, essentially what happened was I gave my microphone a concussion. It's this thing that the two of us do sometimes where I knock it over by accident. And if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see this light is green. And sometimes I hit it and it falls over and it turns red. And so when it turns red, you can't hear me. So I know the last
probably he's a hands talker, gets really excited.
Yeah, I'm sure the last.
I don't know what to do with my hands.
I'm sure the last 7 minutes of the podcast was probably the best in many of your opinions, and I would agree. I love listening to Bridge and Scott, but yeah, I would agree with what you said on the Marner stuff. I'm not gonna step on that one. There was one final question, if you guys don't mind getting to it before we sign off, and this is from Kaylee on YouTube. She says, if Don Sweeney is such a bad general manager, then why was he selected to GM Team Canada for Four Nations? He loaded up the 22-23 roster, and it was Monty that shit the bed on that cup run. Kaylee didn't say this. I'll add this in there, and the players. Hypothetically, if they had won the cup in 23, do people still think Sweeney should be fired? So this is why Sweeney is such a polarizing figure for Bruins fans, because many Bruins fans will look at the good, look at the bad, say, you know what? He's not close to perfect, but he's made mistakes, but most GMs do, all GMs do. He's put the Bruins in positions to succeed. There's been times where, to Kaylee's point, the roster and the coaching staff came up short. 2019, we can sit here all we want and say, you know what? That second line of Krejci, DeBrusque, and Carson Kuhlman, or Krejci, DeBrusque, and David Backes wasn't good enough. And I'm not here to even debate that, but you get to a winner-take-all situation, it's tough to put that on the GM. 22-23, tough to put that on Sweeney. So Kaylee's question is legitimate. Of course, there's a lot of things that Sweeney has failed at, and those are not being glossed over here either. But why is he so polarizing? Why is it either he sucks or he's the best? It really does seem to be that there's a big, big divide here.
Well, and I also think, specifically as it relates to why was he GM of Team Canada, by the way, not just for Four Nations, but also for the Olympics, building towards next year, is the Bruins fans who hate Sweeney and think he sucks have a very different opinion of him than the vast majority of the NHL. Hockey people, and not even saying they're necessarily smarter than fans, some of them definitely are, but other GMs, front office people, executives around the league think much more highly of Don Sweeney than Sully, you know, in Somerville does. So,
like, and even all the players, like, you've heard it from, like, Brad Marchand called him the best GM when he got, after he got traded in his press conference.
Because I think in the eyes of those people, and Brian touched on this, is like, his job is to put a competitive team on the ice that has a chance to win it all, that gets to the playoffs and has a chance to win. And they widely view him as successfully doing that for 10 years, which is not easy to do. And so he earns a lot of respect around the league for doing that. And yeah, I think whether it's players, coaches, whoever, they look at the Bruins not actually winning, not ultimately winning the Stanley Cup, and say, well, that's on the players and coaches. Like, they believe Sweeney put them in position a fair number of times, and the product on the ice didn't get the job done, didn't do their part. So, yeah, I also think fans here and media here, because this is just how we're wired, focus on the negatives and ignore the positives, ignore the many good trades he has made, ignore even, you know, second and third round picks that have hit, and focus on the first round picks from 10 years ago that didn't. Like, that's just, that's Boston, right? Like, we focus on the negatives. Whereas I think
not only that, but the seal, like the bar is a championship. Like, the bar isn't somewhere in the middle. Like, because there's been so many titles in Boston, like, that's just the expectation, and anything short of that gets criticized.
Yeah.
And I think that the players, like, just to put one last, like, forward-looking thought on this, I think that the players that are currently in the Bruins organization do believe that he has done what he's needed to do. You heard Nikita Zadorov, and obviously they lost some of their friends at the deadline, and they don't like that at all, but they do believe that going forward, he is going to put a competitive team out there as soon as next year, and they are not going to be wasting their careers in an organization that isn't going to go for it. That is what Nikita Zadorov talked about at breakup day. He said he fully believes that Sweeney and Neely, he didn't mention it by name, but he said GM and president. So he thinks that they're on the right track. And he said he's excited to see what the offseason holds, the moves that they're going to make, because he believes that they truly are going to make sure the team is competitive again next year and not waste Pasternak's good years, McAvoy's good years, his and both of the Lindholm's good years. Like, he specifically brought that up during one of his answers on breakup day. So maybe that gives a little bit of perspective as to why guys sign for the Bruins. Maybe players from the outside who are free agents are looking at that and seeing what Sweeney has done and the mindset that he has is a positive thing, a thing that attracts them to Boston. It sounds like that's what happened with Nikita Zadorov. It sounds like that's what happened with Elias Lindholm and other guys that have come to join the organization. So as long as the players around the league think that he's a good GM and that he's on the right track and he's going to put together great teams that are competitive, that's an asset for the Bruins.
Yeah, I think the other thing I play here too is that he's been in the position for 10 years. So anytime someone is in a public job for a decade, everybody has that much of a track record to see what he's done well, what he's done wrong, and garner ammunition about just those things, right? So it's uncommon for a GM in Boston to have 10 years of a Rolodex of things that they could have done better or did well at. And so that just feeds in people that dislike Sweeney. They have 10 years of reasons why. People that like Sweeney have 9 for the most part to say, well, he did well these years. Now, look, I'll say this. I think there's Bruins fans that want Sweeney and Neely gone yesterday. I don't think it's going to happen this coming season, but I will say this. If you're a Bruins fan, if Don and you don't like Don Sweeney, Well, if they fail next year and don't make the playoffs, I think there's a good chance he's gone. So you'll get your wish. If Don Sweeney is still here after next year, it probably means it's because he did a great job over the summer and the Bruins got back to the playoffs. So as a Bruins fan, I don't think they're just going to keep a GM who keeps missing the playoffs. Like, if you're clamoring for his job, one day you'll get your wish and you can do all the celebrating you want because somebody will have lost their job. But in the meantime, he's not going anywhere right now. And I know people are skeptical and not trusting his ability to hit on this year's first round draft pick. All I'm going to say is this. There's a difference between drafting in the top 10, where we know that actually, let's just call it top 7, because that's the furthest the Bruins can drop. You really got to try hard to fuck up that pick. And I know people talk about 2015, and I hear you loud and clear. Jake DeBrusk and Jake Zboril, they were drafted relatively where they were ranked. Seneschin, he reached three galaxies for that pick. I will never understand that one. But two of those three picks, he picked the players that were supposed to go where they went. I know it's easy to say, yeah, but Connor, yeah, but Besser. Like I hear all that, and I'm not even disputing it. But even that 2015 first round, Zboril didn't pan out as an NHL player. He was ranked in the top 15 or 16 skaters, I think, in that draft, or close to it. So it's just when you're drafting even higher than that, you're really going to try hard to not take one of the best players available in the top 7 picks. So I feel like a blind squirrel could make this pick for the Bruins. I really do. I don't know why people are so scared about this opportunity. If it was in the 20s, sure. But I don't know. I just think let's just see how it plays out. He's very polarizing. I get it. I don't know what a lot of Bruins fans are going to do if and when they do fire him. And then there's a GM without 10 years of a track record to point at and bitch about. It's going to be very foreign for Bruins fans to not be able to. How are you going to shit on a GM that's been in the job for a week? I'm sure we'll find a way. But until that happens, Don's still the whipping boy.
By the way, good setup. To lead into what's coming up this week and for our next episode, because on Wednesday, we will hear from Charlie Jacobs, Don Sweeney, and Cam Neely over at TD Garden for their end of season press conferences. And then we're going to have a podcast reacting to it.
Yeah. You know, we're going to go ask some tough questions, right, Scott? You got all your questions in line?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're tough questions, but I definitely have like a list of questions I want to ask. And I think some of them hopefully will give us some idea of the direction and the expectations for this team, specifically over the next 12 months, because I know that, you know, Charlie Jacobs tells the Globe it's a retool, not a rebuild. I am fascinated by like how realistic they think that is. And what are the consequences if it doesn't happen? Like, you know, is there some sort of mandate for this team to be back in the playoffs next year?
Scott McLaughlin, WEI. Hey, Don, just curious, want to circle back. You guys drafted Trent Frederick, Johnny Beecher with the intention in the first round of being third, fourth line players. Can you talk to me about that philosophy and why you guys decided to draft players with high floors, low ceilings?
You know what is funny about that is like, I hear from fans on Twitter and like people lumping Dean Letourneau into that as like, oh, they just drafted another fourth liner. And it's like Dean Letourneau is about as opposite of a draft pick from Johnny Beecher and Trent Frederick as you could get. Like those were in theory, like high floor, low ceiling type of players. Like Dean Letourneau was a swing for the fences. Now it may very well not pan out. Year one post-draft did not look good, but there was nothing safe about picking Dean Letourneau. Like,
no.
That was a high upside, high risk swing.
Mm-hmm. The questions I think I want to hear the answers to, that if I have the opportunity, I will ask. I want to ask about how they're going to conduct their coaching search. Like, I'm just interested in, you know, any information at all that they'd be willing to share about, you know, what their plan is for that. And then obviously there's going to be a lot of questions about contracts because Johnny Beecher's up, your guy Cousy's up. geeky. There's plenty of contract related questions to be asked in terms of like, you know, hey, did you have conversations? Are you close to anything? A lot of times you don't get great answers, honestly, to those, but they're still worth asking. I mean, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes like Sweeney has told us before, like who they're extending or not extending, but sometimes that's closer to the draft. Sometimes that's a pre-draft press conference. So to quickly touch on another question we didn't have time for, but someone asked about the timeline for decisions on restricted free agents. That's, they don't have to officially issue those qualifying offers until, I think it's like 2 days after the draft. Brian says there was Kim who asked that. That was part of her email. So, but yeah, like in theory, you might not know the decisions on the RFAs and qualifying offers until the end of June, basically until the draft.
Yeah. Unless they're like, hey, we somehow got this deal done, or hey, we decided we're not going to talk to X player anymore because we're going to move on, or any information at all. Maybe we get nothing, but you have to ask and see if there's, you know, news in those fronts.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap it up, guys. We appreciate everybody's questions very much. We're going to rely on you throughout the summer to keep these mailbags coming, because it's going to be a longer summer than usual, as we know. And you guys are as much a part of this podcast as the three of us are. So thanks for submitting questions. As they alluded to and talked about, there's going to be the management and ownership brass speaking on Wednesday. And so I don't want to promise that we'll have time on Wednesday to drop an episode, but certainly by Thursday morning, we'll cover it.
Yep.
All right. So we can always update on Twitter too when it's coming up. But Bridget and Scott, do you have anything else before we go?
Nope.
Mm-mm.
All righty. Thank you all very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you soon.